Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Blood We Crave, Part 2, by Monty J. Narrated by Lucy Rivers and Grayson Owens. I have crossed oceans of time to find you. Bram Stoker, Dracula.
Prologue. Unknown. I did all of this for her, so that we could be together. And yet, she mourns him. I killed so many for her, will continue to kill them, and instead of seeking comfort in my arms, she mourns. Soon, she will see how ungrateful she has been. Soon, Stephen will own this town, and the darkened suns of Ponderosa Springs will be the end of a baleful reign. So very soon, sweet Lyra will be mine and only mine, as it should have always been. Soon, she will see why I had to do this, why it's only her that can love a man like me. There will be no stopping us, stopping me. The untouchable Hollow Boys will reap not only what they have sowed, but the fruits of their legacy. Their thrones, built from treacherous demands and crowns forged from bones, are crumbling. They are weak, breakable. Love has exposed their humanity. Here lies the thin line between gods and monsters. They will all see, Lyra will see, that those boys they mark with divinity are simply a false claim. There is no divine right and no god to protect them. They bleed, and when they do, they will flow red.
Chapter 1. An Oath to the Dead. Lyra. The cemetery has always been a place of refuge for me. Solemn, forgotten ground that makes the world feel less desolate, only because it's a reminder of how many souls still exist in the ether. It allows for a macabre sort of perspective no other living place can handle. Today, the tombstones do not soothe me. Today, they are a reminder of all that was lost, all the lives that met their conclusion. Cemeteries are a place of peace. Funerals are a bitter nudge towards a future without someone you love.
It's so terribly sad. A woman next to me sobs into a tissue. No one deserves to die like that.
I never thought I'd live to see the last of the Pearsons,
her husband mutters, a thought I'm sure he didn't mean to say out loud. Or maybe he did. Maybe he's better than the rest, and instead of playing nice, he was tired of hiding his disdain. This lady cries again, the wet sound making my ears burn. I whip my head from the fresh hole in the ground, where a black coffin remains motionless, and openly glare at the middle-aged woman, completely uncaring if she or her husband notice. My grief is a tangible feeling, one that mingles with the current rage thrumming in my veins. The snow melts as it touches my skin, seeping into the fabric of my floor-length lace dress. How dare she sit here and cry for a family she openly talked shit about for years? How dare they have a right to be here? All these citizens with their fraudulent condolences, making this more of a social event than a goddamn mourning ceremony, only showing up to catch up on all the hot gossip. Look at me, they all say, showing up in their finest silks and pearls, armed with counterfeit tears and bullshit apologies. You didn't even know, I start, my tone laced with untamed venom. But I'm stopped by a large hand resting on my shoulder, tugging me backwards into their space. I cut my eyes upward, staring into Alistair's dark eyes as he gives me what I assume is a look of disapproval, a silent warning, and a reassuring squeeze of his fingers.
They aren't worth it,
he mutters lowly.
Don't let them win by making it about them. It's what they want. This town will only eat you if you let them take the first bite.
I try to jerk my arm from his hold, but he just holds tighter. You're not my keeper. I'm capable of handling myself. It could rip me apart for all I care, as long as I take my chunk of flesh before they finish me off. This town turned the entire Pearson family into a ghost story, a haunted tale, a fucking plague, and made sure everyone who would listen knew how evil they all were. Now they stand here in mourning? They show up and disrespect the dead.
I'm well aware of what you're capable of.
Then I think you should let go of me, I say through gritted teeth. I don't want to hurt Alistair, but I also don't want him to coddle me either.
I know you're hurting, and you want to make sure everyone else hurt too.
He breathes.
I know what that feels like, Lyra. But you can't, right now.
My molars grind against one another. That's supposed to make it better? I'm just supposed to stand here and, what, do nothing? That's all we have been doing. And look how that turned out for us, Alistair. Caldwell's eyebrows twitch, his mouth twisting slightly. And I can see the pain in his eyes. If I was thinking rationally, I'd be aware that what happened wasn't his fault. I would have maybe hugged him and supported him because he'd lost pieces of himself, too. But I was empty. I am empty. This hollow, dark space that allows no light or air. So I compensate by shoving anger into that bottomless pit inside of me just to feel anything other than this constant ache. The ache of losing him is brutal. I don't miss him the way you miss a pair of shoes that you grew out of, a memory of a glowing summer, or even a pet you lost. I do not miss him. He is missing from me. A vital organ torn from my gut. A severed limb. Thatcher's memory was what I clung to every single second when I was passed around from different foster homes and orphanages. I held on to the boy who made me feel less alone on a night when everything had been taken from me, when I had absolutely nothing. I had him for that short, brief time. He was it. He was all I had. How could no one understand that? I held on to him through school, the little pieces I gathered watching him all these years, tightened my grip on the person who made me feel human, seen, safe. My heart and soul were never mine. They had always been his, and now they belong to no one. They are lost, forgotten, alone. I tethered myself to him, and now he's just gone. He is gone, and his memory isn't enough. Yet it feels like all I have left.
You're always allowed to do something, Lyra. I just don't need you stabbing someone in the eye at a public funeral. That's the last thing you need right now.
Words I don't mean but can't keep down spurt from my mouth before I have a chance to stop them. Stop acting like you fucking care about me. I look at him, meeting his dark eyes. I'm Briar's friend. You're only doing this for her benefit, and frankly, I don't need you protecting me. Remember what happened last time you told me I'd be safe? I almost died. This time, I do remove my arm from his grasp, probably because he let me. But I'm free from his control either way. I've never spoken to him like this. I've never spoken to anyone this way before. But I don't regret it. Not when all this bitterness has consumed every ounce of kindness that once lived inside of me.
Fine.
He scoffs, shoving his hands in his jacket.
Then how about this? If you do anything fucking stupid at this funeral and put Briar at risk, I will show you just how little I care about what happens to you.
I'd been waiting for him to bite, knowing I could only poke at Alistair Caldwell so long before he snapped back. The sting of his words doesn't land as hard as I expected they would. The numbness is the likely cause. Or maybe it's because I knew from the start that was our relationship. Fine, I agree. The snow begins to fall in a heavy flurry, and I watch as guests pile into their cars, seeking warmth. The show has come to an end, leaving only a few people lingering in the Pearson family cemetery.
Incoming.
Alistair tosses his head to our right, and I follow the direction carefully, seeing the federal agents who'd approached us in Tilly's diner weeks ago, moving in sync with one another. They approach us. Hope they aren't trying to blend in.
They want us to know they're here. It's an intimidation tactic, making sure we know they're watching us.
Odette Marshall, shoves her hands in her pockets, offering a welcoming smile as she steps in front of me. The man she'd introduced as Garrick brushes her shoulder, nodding at Alistair in silent acknowledgement.
"We wanted to stop by and offer our condolences for your loss," she says, so casually, dripping with fake sincerity,
and I've had just about enough phony emotional displays to last a lifetime. I'm not in the mood to play nice, especially with them. Neither Alistair nor I say anything in response to her opening statement. We just stare blankly, waiting for her to get to whatever point she has.
"Listen," she levels. "All we want to do is help. I know you may not see that right now, but we just want those responsible for these crimes to pay for them."
"You should take your help elsewhere," I snip. Maybe it's the bite of the cold or the sting of loss, but I feel like an exposed nerve. Every whisper of air across me sends an agonized bolt of pain through my body.
"Is that your way of telling me you know more information than you're giving, and want me to stop poking around?"
"No," I say. "If that's what I meant, I would have said it." Odette smirks, rolling her lips together as she nods.
"If your plan is to interrogate us at a funeral, it's not only shit taste, but our lawyer won't appreciate it either."
Alistair curls his hand around my upper arm.
"We told you everything we know."
Which is true. When the two of them showed up at the home on Pearson Point and found us already there, they were quick to request our presence at the station house. I'd been unfeeling to the entire experience, practically silent, barely aware that Rook Van Doren's father had forked up the bill for my lawyer, who did most of the talking for me. A pleasant gentleman, who made it very clear if either of the detectives or anyone else with a badge tried to speak to us without him around, they'd regret it.
"I somehow doubt that,"
Garrick speaks for the first time.
"Your loyalty will be your downfall, and the killer doesn't even deserve it. Thatcher..."
"Don't say his fucking name," I snap, taking a step in their general direction with no fear of repercussions. What do I have left to lose? "You don't get to say that name." My hands curl into tight fists, my fingers bunching up the material at the sides of my dress. I feel Alistair's hand squeeze my arm, not from anger or Garrick's comment, but to hold me back from doing something I might regret, like strangling this prick with my bare hands. But in no universe do I find myself having remorse for this jarhead.
"Watch yourself, little girl."
I step a little closer, pointing one accusatory finger, unafraid of his stature and blank expression. "It seems you have your priorities a little skewed if you're treating him more like a suspect instead of a missing person." Those words echo inside me, bouncing off the walls of my vacant chest. That might be what hurts the most, not knowing if he's dead or alive. If this copycat killer has him as leverage for the halo, or has already tossed his body into the ocean as fish food. I don't know where he is. I can't find him. None of us can.
"Until I find his body, Thatcher Pearson is our number one suspect in the murder of those girls and May Pearson. I get used to it now, so it won't be so difficult adding money to his books when I throw his ass in prison."
"Just how dumb are you?" I counter. "Find the easiest target and pin him with murder? Get some evidence other than your ego, dickhead." My stomach twists, my hands flexing at my sides. The vivid image of gutting Garrick Knight with the pin in my hair becomes more appealing by the second. The metallic taste rushing to my mouth is hard to swallow, and I know my self-control isn't wound as tightly as Thatcher's. That was the whole point of him teaching me, how to control it so that I didn't do what I desperately wanted to do right now. These useless cops are hunting Thatcher down for a crime he didn't commit, instead of searching for him. They don't understand that he would never kill May, that none of those girls dying is his fault. They expect me to believe they're here to help, when all they've done is crucify those around me with no evidence.
"I respect you wanting to protect your friend. He's lucky to have a girl like you."
Odette steps in, her tone nothing short of condescending.
"But if I find out you know where he is, or what his next move is, I will charge you all with harboring a fugitive. You can be loyal in a cell."
"All good over here?"
Rook's hand appears on Alistair's shoulder, a forced smile on his pale face. The tension is so thick it almost chokes me, a heavy smog weighing on my lungs. I feel my friend's step next to me. Briar's hand slips into mine and gives it a squeeze. But I can't bring myself to return the favor. Not when I feel like this. Jaded. So vacant that I can't make myself be there for anyone. Not even myself. Both she and Sage are trying too hard, desperately trying to help me. But I'm too far gone, too secluded in the darkness to even see their hands reaching for me. I've turned into that dark spot inside of myself, allowing it to take me over.
Perfect, Alistair says through clenched teeth. We were just leaving.
Both detectives look at us lined up in a row, eyeing each of us with careful glances. It feels like the start of another battle in this never-ending war. A line drawn in the white snow in front of us, painting a clear picture of what side we all stand on. I'm sure Odette and Garrick feel that where they stand is on the right side of the law, that they are doing good by being here. But if you're not on our side, no matter the reason, then you're against us. They are the enemy by default.
It will only be you who is hurt in the end, Odette says to each of us, but is quick to make eye contact with me with her goodbye.
Ask yourself, would he return this favor of silence? Would he put his freedom at risk for you? We turn, walking away and giving our final goodbyes to the woman about to be covered in dirt. Sweet May, possibly the only innocent person involved in this web we found ourselves trapped in. She didn't deserve this. To die like that. Cut up. Dissected. Robbed of her heart. She'd done nothing but show each of these broken men a mother's love, guiding and protecting them since they were young. I know their guilt is heavy. We all feel responsible for her death and Thatcher's disappearance. Rook squats down, pulling a coin from his pocket and flipping it. It rings in the air as it hits the wooden coffin.
We will make them pay for this, May. I promise you.
A tear slips down my cheek. I bite back a choked sob.
We swear on the River Styx.
Alistair's voice sounds like he's choked on gravel, and I watch his gold coin tumble into the hole, landing with a thud. River Styx? Sage asks curiously, blue eyes veiled with tears and pale skin tinted pink. Homer wrote that the gods swear by the water of the Styx. It's their most binding oath, I answer, chewing the inside of my cheek and allowing the silence to overtake us all. It's an unbreakable promise. Chapter 2. To Become a Killer. Lyra. I turn the key on the music box once again, twisting until the tension is pulled tight before releasing it and filling my room with the sound once more. The twinkling melody echoes around the four walls, and it hadn't taken me long to figure out the song's title. Once Upon a Dream was a song my mother used to hum while she was working around the house or in the kitchen trying to cook, and sometimes she'd sing while she got me ready for bed. It's a tune I'd remember anywhere, and I wasn't sure if it was fate or some kind of destiny that I found this little trinket in the library tower. Either way, it brings me a strange sense of comfort, and for that, I am thankful. My phone vibrates on the bed next to me, and I don't have to look at the screen to know it's Briar calling. Again. I continue to let it ring as I stare up at the ceiling, my fingers tracing the golden swirls along the base of the box until the sound runs out. Sitting the whimsical object on the bed, I scoop up my phone and quickly send a text to my worried friend. B. Happy New Year! We miss you! How could it have possibly been a month already? How is it the start of the new year without him here? Me. Happy New Year. Miss you guys too. Just don't want to talk tonight. B. Lyra. B. We haven't seen you since the funeral. Why won't you let us be there for you? I type half the message, then think better of it. I don't want to tell my best friend over a text that I don't want her over here so that she can sit and tell me it's going to be okay, that things will get better. Not when she was so hell-bent on me staying away from Thatcher in the first place. I'm not saying I wouldn't have done the same thing in her position, but she only had surface-level information when it came to my situation, which, admittedly, is my fault. But he made me promise. What happened between us was to stay quiet, I would take Protective Briar over Thatcher, seeing me as disloyal. Me. Just want to be alone, is all. B. B. We could come over and help you clean. I know there were at least 10 empty water bottles on your bedside dresser. We don't even have to talk. Alistair is worried, too. I let myself stare into the void for another moment longer before wincing as I looked over at my nightstand, which does in fact have way too many plastic containers littering it. I can't even feel embarrassed as I look at the state of my room, the hanging and potted plants scattered around in desperate need of water, dust coating the shelves that hold different taxidermy items, trash on the floor, clothes thrown about. The only thing I've had the energy to do is feed Alvi. His two-story terrarium is the cleanest thing in my home. I'm better at taking care of my white kingsnake than myself. Forcing myself to sit up, I kick a pair of dirty jeans across the room as I walk quietly to my closet, admiring what used to be my safe haven of a room, now turned into a tornado of depression. It's the last space in the cabin I had remodeled. I'd curated every inch, taking my time to thrift every golden picture frame that showcases different bug species. I bought several different animal skulls, which are neatly placed on my floor-to-ceiling bookshelves. I selected furniture, plants, and even my black velvet headboard with the hopes of creating a space that felt like mine, my own little forgotten corner of the world. An entire year I'd spent designing and restoring my home, only to let it dwindle into a nest of self-loathing. I can't even bring myself to be sad about it. Not when everything feels so bleak. I don't want to see anyone or do anything. Why would I, when I'm constantly alternating between quiet depression and unbridled anger? My pain is a warpath, hostile interactions, and a constant need to make everyone around me feel this loss. Opening the door to my closet, I quickly tug the black sweater from the hanger, pressing the soft material to my nose and inhaling the faint remains of his cologne. Tears sting my eyes, and I rub my fist in front of my chest to relieve the burning sensation that has started. I want so desperately to believe he's alive, that he's okay, and somehow will find his way back. Yet, it's been a month since May's murder, and we can't find a trail to follow. I have no answers, just a pathetic hope that he's out there somewhere, still breathing. I'm not sure how long I stand in here, far too long to be considered healthy for my current mental state. But once I find the motivation to go downstairs and rummage through my cabinets for a tea bag, I'm soon disappointed when I find the tin empty. I would laugh, but the humor in the situation dies when I realize I'll have to go into town to buy more. For a moment, I think of asking Briar if she could bring me some, and she would. But then she'd ask to stay, weasel her way inside with her soft smile, sage in tow, with a stash of Rook's weed that she steals, and we'd spend the night on a pile of blankets in front of my TV, all of us pretending to be normal college students while the world outside my door falls to shit. It would be fun, and I almost work up enough energy to commit, but it disappears quickly. Mentally, I won't be able to handle the pity in their eyes or be very good company, because it feels impossible to hide my worry. I'm constantly thinking about how long it will be before I see him again. Another month? Years? Never? That seems like a reality too hard to bear, and I want to put off the acceptance of his death, but every day it gets harder to have hope. Grabbing my frumpy plaid coat, I slip my feet into a pair of yellow rain boots that are sitting by the door. I catch a quick glimpse of myself in the mirror by the front door, wincing at the dark circles beneath my eyes. I'm sure somewhere in the world, the gothic lace gown I wore to the funeral paired with this jacket and these boots is high fashion. Here, it's unlikely someone would pay attention to me long enough to notice. I'm not sure why I put it on this morning. Maybe to remember. To grieve or feel the pain of loss. I've always been a sucker for sinking into my self-pity. The high lace collar that wraps around my neck scratches against my skin as the heat from my car blasts against my face. Quietly, I drive through the flurry of snow, watching the sun drift away, allowing darkness to soak the pines. I'm pleased to see the parking lot barren, save for a few cars. I just wish the fluorescent bulbs inside the store weren't so fucking bright. Feeling like a vampire as the light burns my skin and eyes, I try to shield myself from the harsh glow. Normally, I'd spent hours inside the store, wandering down aisles and discovering new foods to fixate on, or sweets I had yet to try. Now, all I want is to get back home, to curl into my blankets and sleep for the next half century. Maybe, when I woke up, this would all be over. The halo would be destroyed, the copycat killer behind bars, and my friends would be happy. At the very least, we all would find some peace. I'm chewing my bottom lip, trying to decide which flavor of tea I want for the next week. Lady Grey, chai, lemon delight, ginger black, English breakfast, pomegranate. Heavy boots thud against the tiled floor, wet stomps from the snow outside. I can't explain how I know, but I feel the moment the person turns into the aisle. The hairs along my neck stand up in warning, my heart beating just a bit faster. The sound of a cart moving echoes in my ears, and I silently turn my head. What I find is a surprise. Clothed in a starched button-down and slacks, whistling with every step forward, is a man who has haunted my sleep. Player One. The man who'd tied me to a chair, beaten me until I was bruised, and attempted to drown me, strolls down the aisle with lax confidence. Unaware of my presence, he looks like an average guy just getting off work, stopping by the store to grab whatever item his wife texted him to pick up. Or maybe his husband. Either way, there is a golden band wrapped around his finger, meaning he belongs to someone. Even someone as vile as him belongs to another person. And he may not be the sole reason, but he is part of why I do not share that quality. Why the person that belongs to me is no longer here. He must sense my gaze because he looks around until we make eye contact. Recognition flares, and it's obvious he knows who I am. Hunger pulls in my stomach, a familiar itch starting along my fingertips. I feel like my blood might set on fire as the electric hum of opportunity races through me. Wrath strikes through my veins with violent speed, and I look at Player One, not as my attacker, but as something far better. An outlet. All of this miserable rage and guilt finally has a place to go, given the perfect chance to quench my thirst for revenge, even if it's for a moment. I tighten my hands into fists, turning my knuckles white. It was all their fault. His fault. They are the reason Thatcher is missing from me. For all I know, this man could be the person who killed him. Knowing that he is already a dog for Stephen Sinclair means I wouldn't doubt his involvement. What I'd done to his partner, Michael, the other man who'd laid his hands on my body and tried to end my life, was only a preview of what I wanted to put Player One through. I warned them what I would become if they took him from me. Now there is no need to fear the Reaper. They should fear the woman who loves him. Giving a soft smile, I hide any recognition and turn back to the tea selections while he stares at the back of my head. I let him look at me, calculate his plan on how to get rid of me. The fear I'd once harbored for the craving that lives inside of me is no longer there. I've embraced what Henry Pearson turned me into, and I'm ready to let it off the chain. Except this time, I don't need a reason to hurt Player One. I don't need an excuse or something to ease my future guilt. I no longer care if he's done something wrong or deserves death. I'm going to kill him for only one reason. Because I want to. Nothing but the overwhelming desire to feel his blood between my fingers. Plucking a random tea from the shelf, I turn on my heel, making my rain boots squeak. I walk out of the island towards the checkout, knowing he is behind me almost every step. He looms like a shadow as I pay, taking the bag from the rack.
Have a good night.
I will, I replied to the teenage cashier. With a steady walk, I settle into the eerie calm that falls upon my shoulders. I stroll to the doors and head into the snow once again. Sliding my hand into the pocket of my jacket, I run my fingers along the smooth metal that's tucked away. It's one of the more expensive items I'd stolen from Thatcher, but possibly one of my favorites. I'd taken it from him our sophomore year of high school after taking a week to figure out his locker combination. I also stole a pack of gum from him that day. I rub my thumb along the switchblade, coaxing the memory of him. All the things Thatcher had taught me. Being precise, having a plan, being in control, seemed to flutter to the back of my mind as I walked to my car. My only plan is that I'll be breaking one of his most important rules.
Do not kill out of emotion.
Tonight, I am killing out of purely that. taking a life not to better society or help, but to aid the ache inside.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?